Today's Taisho will be on case 62 in the Hikigan Roku. I'm sorry, pardon me. Case 62 in the Book of Serenity. Case 62 is entitled Mihu's Enlightenment or Not. Introduction. Bodhidharma's highest truth, Emperor Wu's confusion, Vimalakirti's teaching of non-duality, Manjushri's verbal excess. Is there anyone who has the ability to enter in actively? Mihu had a monk ask Yangshan, do people these days need enlightenment or not? Yangshan said, it's not that there is no enlightenment, but what can be done about falling into the secondary? The monk went back and reported this to Mihu, who deeply agreed with this. Verse. The secondary, distinguishing enlightenment, breaking up delusion. Quickly you should free your hands and relinquish net and trap. Accomplishment, before it's exhausted, becomes an extra thumb. Wisdom can hardly know, like you can't bite your own navel. The full moon's icy disk weeps in the autumn dew. The birds are cold in the jade tree. The dawn breeze is chill. Brought forth great yang, distinguishes real and false. Completely without flaw, the white jade is esteemed. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning. It's wonderful to see everybody here. So let me read the case one more time. Mihu had a monk ask Yangshan. So Mihu is a teacher, a Zen teacher, a master. And he has one of his monks go to Yangshan's temple and ask Master Yangshan a question. Do people these days need enlightenment or not? And, you know, if we look around, we would say, absolutely, you know, people desperately need enlightenment. What a confused mess our society is. Yangshan said, it's not that there is no enlightenment, but what can be done about falling back into the secondary? That's how Yangshan answers. So then the monk went back and reported this to Mihu. He, who, deeply agreed with this. Okay, so that's the case. So, there are many ways to think about enlightenment, and there's many ways to think about Zazen, right? So the commonest way of thinking about meditation practice is that we are sitting down on the cushion and we are trying to become enlightened beings. We know that we're not. I mean, that's how we get started in Zazen. I can remember when I was in graduate school, I had a lot of problems. I have difficulties dealing with the competitiveness of graduate school. I had difficulties dealing with my lack of preparedness for graduate school. And other difficulties as well. And I heard about a Zen center that had just begun when Takabayashi Genki Roshi was just arriving in Seattle from Ryutakuji. And I went to sit with him. And it definitely helped me. And I thought, you know, I'm very far from being enlightened. I'm deeply neurotic. I'm fearful. I think sometimes I'm a little depressed. That's what I realized at the time. And when I went to sit, I did feel better. And when I began to feel better, I began to think about this thing called enlightenment. I had read a fair number of books on Buddhism. And one of them was by the great Japanese scholar D.T. Suzuki. And Suzuki is a fascinating person. He had a degree, a PhD in English literature that he got in Japan. He trained with a very famous Zen master named Soyin Shaku. And Suzuki came to the United States, I believe he came here in his 40s, and he began to write on Zen. And he acquired an international audience. Really, people revered him at the time. And he is a fascinating, deeply knowledgeable interpreter of Buddhism, Japanese Buddhism, and Zen, Chan in particular. And I remember reading his collections of essays and filling them with underlines, right? And commenting in the margins, you know? And I remember also how deeply impressed I was by his emphasis on enlightenment, the enlightenment experience. He would include poems by Zen masters about moments when somebody is right on the edge of having a Daikensho, great awakening. And then maybe the teacher pushes them, or they hear a pebble hitting a piece of bamboo, or something else happens. They stub their toe, and suddenly they have this transformative experience. And one great Japanese poet describes it, it's like the bucket, the bottom has fallen out of the bucket. It's like there was a bottom in this wooden bucket, and now the bottom has fallen out, and you look through it, and you can see all the way through. See? And I have to say, that was very exciting to me. The idea that, we know we're in samsara, the word samsara, it was the Buddha's word for like ordinary consciousness. And so I knew I was in samsara. That was pretty clear. And I wanted to get out of samsara. So these stories about great Zen masters breaking through, I found incredibly thrilling, right? And they often involve heroic feats of meditation, right? So, meditating for 20 hours straight, not getting any sleep. You can go on and on, right? And the literature of Zen is filled with these awakening stories, right? Somebody, Rinzai slaps somebody's face and he has an awakening. Or Nansen pushes somebody out the back door and they fall in the mud and have an awakening experience. And I have to say that for a long time I was practicing, constantly sort of waiting for this awakening experience. And the idea of it was, hugely exciting to me. And I remember going one time to the Seattle Asian Museum of Art. And if you ever get to Seattle and you have a chance to see it, I highly recommend it because they have this amazing collection of Asian art. Really amazing. Some of the best Chinese, East Asian art around, and also some very good Indian art, statues especially, Indian sculpture. But they have an amazing collection of Chinese and Japanese, screens. There's a very famous screen called The Thousand Crows. It's this beautiful, beautiful screen of, there aren't really a thousand crows, but there's a bunch of crows against this gold leaf background. And the crows are so lifelike in their rendering that it's magical, right? And I remember going there one day and turning, and there was a statue of a monk having Daikensho. And he's on a meditation bench in China, as in Japan. Monks traditionally sat on something called a tan, or a bench. And there, on each side, each wall of the Zen hall, there's a tan, and or a bench. It's like this giant bench, and monks put their cushions on that bench, and they sit on the bench, and there's a little door. There's little compartments under the bench where they can put their shoes and stuff. So anyway, this monk is having a daikensho, and his eyes are wide, and he's turning, looking at something we don't see, because he's turning and looking at enlightenment. And his face is rapt. It's beautiful. Right? He doesn't have a particularly beautiful face, as a matter of fact. He's kind of, if we saw him, we would say he's not a physically attractive person. But he's turning, and the beauty of his face as he's experiencing this enlightenment is so powerful and compelling. It's like he's turning, he looks, and he sees it. And you want to see it too. You know, so what is he seeing? What is he seeing? And he's actually breaking from his regular meditation practice. It's a beautiful statue. You know, instead of sitting solidly in a Zazen posture, one of his feet is coming off the tan, and he's looking up, and one of his hands is on his leg, right? And it's really, it's just a masterpiece. I don't know why more people don't know about it. It doesn't photograph well, but it's so beautiful. Anyway, that haunted me. You know, that statue was just so gorgeous. So, you know, for a long time, I definitely thought that I was trying to wake up. You know, and my teacher would say, we're here to try to wake up. We're here to try to wake up. And, you know, over time, I think this created some problems for me as a Zen practitioner. You know, every time I would go to Sesshin, I was hoping to have a daikensho, or great awakening experience. And when I would go to Sesshin, I would really sit. I was a serious Zen practitioner. I tried very hard to practice Zen, you know, with my whole being. And you know, I would go to this Sesshin and try, and sometimes I couldn't answer my koan very often. And I would leave Sesshin sometimes feeling like I had failed the test, you know, like I hadn't, maybe I hadn't done enough, you know, maybe I should have tried harder, that kind of thing. And also there was a vague sense of discontent, right? Like I want this. Now, you know, it didn't drive me crazy. It wasn't like, you know, I couldn't sleep because I hadn't had daikensho, but it's a kind of, it was an aspiration that I carried with me for a long time. And over time, I think it created problems for me. I think it actually made my practice less positive in a certain way, you know? In other words, you know, I'm striving for something that I can't achieve. And when you're striving for something that you can't achieve, especially, you know, especially in our culture, you know, you work harder, you try harder. And then, you know, when you work harder and you try harder and it doesn't work out, right, it doesn't work out, then, you know, very often you begin to blame yourself. You begin to blame yourself. And the thing about enlightenment is, you know, you can't make it happen, right? You can't, there's really nothing you can do. But I wanted this experience of enlightenment so much. I remember one time we had Sesshin at this cabin on the Hood Canal. And there were so many people at Sesshin. It was a pretty big cabin, but there were so many people there that we were all sleeping on the floor in our sleeping bags and with our sleeping mats, a little like the way it used to be at my house when we used to do Sesshin there. I remember having this dream. In my dream, I was staring at the wall of the cabin, and suddenly I could see like the luminous Buddha coming through the wall. And I thought, you know, in my dream, I actually thought, oh, I'm having daikensho. But of course, I woke up and I'm lying in my sleeping bag. And I wanted to go back and see the luminous Buddha, but, you know, I didn't, that didn't happen. So You know, there is something to this idea of striving for enlightenment. And one of the reasons I got excited in Zen was, excited about Zen by reading D.T. Suzuki, was that he had this very powerful sense of drama, the drama of awakening. It was really, it's really beautiful and inspiring, right? You know, it brings the whole terrain of Zen practice alive, right? So you know, I highly recommend Suzuki. I don't know if he would seem to younger people a little bit old-fashioned, but he's really animating. And of course, I read Alan Watts, who also talks a lot about enlightenment. But you know, over time, this was like an unsustainable way to practice. I mean, you can go to sesshins and try, you know, and I think what happened in our Zen center was that, you know, we had a lot of people like me who wanted to have an enlightenment experience and who believed in enlightenment, which is real. I promise you that it's not a fantasy. And these people were, you know, like me, reading D.T. Suzuki or Alan Watts, and they were striving for enlightenment. And they would come to Sesshin, and we would have, at first we used to have Sesshin where we might have 40 people. You know, and then it turned into like 20 people, 25, you know, 40, 25, 20, 15. You know, over time, people began to leave. And I think they began to leave because of the way they understood enlightenment. You know, they were waiting for that breakthrough experience, that dramatic, you know, breakthrough experience where, you know, you're in samsara and then suddenly there's this crash, you know, a thunderclap, and you suddenly see everything in a different way. And that didn't happen to them either, right? So they're trying, but after a while it begins to seem that this is unattainable, right? Unattainable. And indeed, there are Zen stories of people who have been practicing for 40 years and hadn't had their great awakening experience. So I would say that this a way of practicing, this sort of like, do or die, I'm going to wake up, is fairly common, was fairly common in the Zen world. But I think it sets people up for disappointment. And it actually winds up creating a kind of obstacle. You're actually sort of like practicing with a grasping mind, like a grasping mind. It's like you're waiting for something to happen, and when it's not happening, you're grasping even harder. And this, by the way, is a little bit like why I think people should not take psychedelic drugs, you know, if they're practicing Zen. You know, recently somebody asked me about this. They said, well, what about psychedelic drugs? What do you think of that? And I said, you know, people, when they take a drug, can have amazing experiences, some of which are quite dramatic and like a Kensho experience, like an awakening experience. But, you know, what happens with people who take like LSD or psilocybin is that you go through this arc where you're in ordinary consciousness, and then you're out of ordinary consciousness, and then you have this peak experience, and then it declines back down. And you're back sort of into your ordinary consciousness, and you can remember the peak experience. It's like, oh, that was magical, right? You know, and I myself have to say, I did experiment with these when I was in college, right? And there was something wonderful about those peak experiences. And recently, people have talked about psilocybin and LSD in more positive ways. And I think there's a case to be made for these things. But, you know, we were taking those drugs in the 70s to have a peak experience. And then after you take the drugs and you've had the peak experience, You know, if you sit down on the cushion, you're going to want a peak experience, you know. And if you don't get the peak experience, you're going to feel like you're losing or you're not achieving. So I hope this is making some sense. The thing is that you know, in Zen too, in Zen practice too, you can have like peak experiences, right? Where, you know, you're sitting on the cushion and then all of a sudden your body disappears or you feel that your face has disappeared and you have this wonderful sense of freedom and openness, right? And that's a peak experience. But, you know, what can happen is that every time you sit down on the cushion and you try to get back to that place, you can find that it disappears or it's inaccessible to you. And that can lead to sort of like a kind of frustration or disappointment. So there's another way to think about Zen practice that I believe might be more helpful. And I think that in this case, Master Hu is helping us see it. Mi Hu had a monk ask Yang Shan, do people these days need enlightenment or not? Yang Shan said, you know, in other words, look, do they need to have enlightenment? You know, and the conventional Alan Watts, D.T. Suzuki answer would be, enlightenment is something you don't have, it's something you achieve. And Yang Shan said, it's not that there is no enlightenment, but what can be done about falling back into the secondary? The monk went back and reported this to Mihu, who was deeply agreed with us. So, you know, what can this mean? Well, I mean, one way to understand our ordinary life, samsara, is to understand it as the opposite of nirvana, right? So if you think of consciousness as a continuum, and on this side is samsara, and on this side is nirvana, right? And we're somewhere in between, right? And our goal is to get from samsara to nirvana, and it's like a road, right? And I think early Buddhists understood practice like this. We want to leave samsara and enter nirvana. And I do think that early Buddhism thought about it this way. If you read, say, some of the Pali Sutras, they seem to imply that this was the case. But you know, there's another way of thinking about it. You know, if you practice Zazen quite regularly and you sit on a Saturday for, you know, a couple hours, or you go to Sesshin and you sit for a lot of hours, you eventually have this experience where you're in a place where there is no, you could say, time, you know. So you're sitting on the cushion and, you know, for many sits at, say, Sesshin, as the day wears on, your legs get tired, and there are many sits where you're sitting there and you're feeling pain in your legs or pain in your back or emotional pain, right? You know, different kinds of discomfort afflict you, right? And you're watching the breath and watching the breath and you're thinking, when is that guy going to ring the bell? When is he going to end this torture? Right? You know, and then I ring the bell and you perhaps adjust your posture and you sit back down and then all of a sudden, you know, you have this experience where you feel serene, your mind is thoughtless, your emotional distress goes away, and now it's like there's no time. You know, it can be like that. Somebody the other night, I asked people how their sit was, and somebody said that sit went like that. It's just, you know, in this state, there's the consciousness is empty, and because consciousness is empty, there's no time. There's no time sensation. And you know, and you're totally open to the world. So it may be the case that you hear something. When you hear a bird, you just become the sound. There's no barrier between you and what you hear. And in this state of, we could say, samadhi, this special state of concentration, you know, we realize, you can sometimes realize that, first of all, not only is this timeless, but it's also like always here, always here. And if you get to that place, you'll know what I mean. You know, you'll get there and you'll think, oh my God, you know, this is, why don't I notice this? It's right here. It's right here. And, you know, people who have their Daikensho, their great awakening experience, say the same thing. They say, you know, one of the first things they say is, you know, this has always been here. So it's possible that we misunderstand what practice is all about when we think of it as going from point A to point B, from samsara to nirvana. It may be that, you know, nirvana is here all the time. Nirvana's here all the time. And we're just blocking it. Right? It's not something we're trying to achieve. It's something concealed from ourselves, or that we've obstructed from ourselves. And so the goal isn't to get somewhere where we aren't, but to just be fully where we are, to be fully where we are. And that's a very different way of practicing than striving constantly to have a breakthrough, just trying to be fully where you are. So, you know, when you sit down on the cushion, you know, if you imagine an ideal state, that makes it very difficult to practice. But if you say, you know, my job right now is just to be present with what is happening. My job right now is just to be present with what is happening. You know, one way to think about Zazen is that it's a kind of therapy. You know, this is actually not a bad way of thinking about meditation, as like a kind of therapy. You know, it's trying to help us get to this fundamentally enlightened state. And it's trying to get us to like relax into it or let go enough to experience it. You know? So the model of like trying to break through or crash through may be the worst model, right? You know, you sit down on the cushion, and most people bring to the cushion some kind of distress or some kind of longing or some, you know, something's missing, something's not right. And it may be very subtle and it may be very crude. You know, you may have had some recent tragedy in your life and you're trying to come to terms with that. And especially if it's been very wrenching, when we sit down on the cushion, we want to say, you know, get me out of here, you know, get me out. I'm, when I sit down on the cushion sometimes, you know, you might be burning with anxiety or burning with distress, you know, or hurting somehow, you know, or angry. And you know, we want to say, get me out of here. What we want to do is, you know, go into emptiness and get away from those feelings. But another way to practice is to be present with those feelings. So just be, I'm going to watch my breath, and now, you know, let's say sadness is arising, or loss is arising, or something like that. You know, it's just arising. And, you know, we want to push it away, but actually, you know, this is like the door into, and this is like the obstacle becomes the door. You can put it that way. The obstacle becomes the door. So, you know, you're sitting on the cushion and now all of a sudden you're feeling sadness come up. And you realize, you know, I'm sad because, you know, my sister is still in Tokyo and I can't go to see her and I'm worried about her health. And, you know, suddenly the more you become aware of this, you know, more intense your emotional response might be. But you know, if you don't push it away, if you just sit with it, right, you begin to feel this change in yourself, right? It's as though, you know, it's like your hand, you start out with a hand that's a clenched hand, a fist, and gradually you open it up, right? It's like, at first we want to say, I can't believe this is happening, right? I can't believe this is happening. And you sit down in the cushion, and a lot of the early part of a sit, if you're in emotional distress, might be this desire to get away from whatever is causing you unhappiness or distress or fear. But you know, if you begin to just be present with what's happening, you keep coming back to your breath. And there's the fear, there's the anxiety, there's the, you know, the harsh judgment, self-judgment, whatever. You know, after a while, you know, it begins to lose its emotional character. And your mind just becomes empty and still. And this is like magic when this happens, right? It's like absolutely magic. It's not just the particular situation of, say, wrestling with difficult emotions or even wrestling with pain in your body. You know, situation is common. You know, if you look, say, at a candle, some people meditate with a candle. So they put a candle in front of them and they stare at the candle. Or if you have emblem that you meditate on, one of the things you'll notice is that after a while it disappears. You're aware of it, and then it just seems to disappear. Another example is sound. You know, if there's somebody outside your window when you're trying to meditate, and there are cars going by or something, you know, if you are expecting quiet and stillness, you know, every time a car goes by, it's like an offense against you, right? It puts your nerves on end and so on. But if you just sit calmly and you say, I'm going to be present with the sound of cars going by, and you just listen to the sound of cars going by, you know, at some point your aversion or your sense of repulsion goes away, and you begin to feel this sort of imperturbable calm. And then, you know, when you listen to the sound of the cars, you know, you're in a very different place. It's just the sound of the cars. And when you listen to it, your mind goes blank, becomes very empty and clear. You know, at Murray Grove, where we do our sesshin, and hopefully this August we'll be able to do sesshin there too. At Murray Grove, where we do our sesshin, they have a church group, a Unitarian group, that comes in on Sunday morning. And in order to get to their little meeting hall, they have to drive by our zendo. And in the summer, you know, the windows are open. So, you know, we're in there doing zazen. Usually I'm in the dokusan room. And the other people are in the regular main room, and they can hear the crunching of the gravel, the tires on the gravel as they drive by. And people have actually come in and complained to me. And I understand, you know, if you're used to that stillness, you know, suddenly there are these cars driving by on this gravel. It's this crunchy gravel, and you can hear every piece of gravel crunching. You know, it's like, what happened to my beautiful stillness? But if you just say, my job is to be present with what is happening, you know, my job is just to be present with what is happening changes. Another way to put it is your relationship to what is happening changes. So, you know, if you're expecting peace and quiet and the tires are making crunchy noises on the gravel, you know, it will set your nerves on edge. But if you say, you know, my job is just to be present with what's happening, you know, as you hear that gravel, you'll notice your anxiety level begins to drop, your mind begins to empty out, and you begin to feel like you're in the flow. So this is like that experience of like being present or being in it or being in the flow. It's all different ways of describing the same kind of experience. I am present with what is happening now. See, I'm present with what's happening now. This is actually like a highly praised state of awareness, right? Non-discriminating mind. I'm just becoming one with what's happening. And as we enter this non-dualistic, non-discriminating mind, you know, our relationship to everything around us is changed. But it means being willing to be with what is happening. And that can be very difficult. It's easy to do if the issue is the grunt, the crunching of the tires on gravel in the parking lot. But it's much harder to do if you're coping with something that is, you know, personally very challenging, right? It's very hard to feel that you have to be present with this thing you don't want to have happen, and it's happening. So, you know, when we feel out of control, you know, we want control. But often there's no way to get control, right? And so, you know, if you practice with an eye towards escaping from the present moment, you know, that's a kind of search for control. But if you're saying to yourself, my job is to be present with what is happening. My job is to be present with what is happening. 100%. See, you begin to become much closer to your fundamentally awakened mind. And there's a sense of like emerging sense of trust or well-being that arises from this place, and it's counterintuitive, right? It's like when you feel you're in a bad place, you want to leave it. But when you try to leave it and you can't leave it, it only exacerbates your sense of frustration and helplessness and desperation and so on. So you know, the alternative is to say, okay, my job is to be fully present with what's happening, even though it's what I didn't want to have happen, or I don't want this to be the case. And when you're fully present with what is happening, the character of your relationship to it changes. And you begin to feel this deep sense of connection. You know, it's like, this is not what I want to connect with, but you begin to feel this sense of connection. And you realize, you know, all of this is unfolding the way it has to unfold. Everything is happening the way it has to happen. I can't stop it. I can't change it. My job is just to be present with it. Just to be present with it in a non-judgmental mode. Right? It takes some sitting to get to this place. But when you get to this place, it's a kind of liberation. And the more time you spend in that place, the clearer your heart, your kokoro, your sheen will become. And you know, this is such a hard lesson, right? It's like tomorrow you have to do something you desperately don't want to do, right? And you know, how are you going to be? I was just reading this beautiful Japanese poem, and it goes like this. In English, it goes like this. Something like, I always knew this day was going to come, but I didn't know it was going to be today. You know, that is so beautiful, right? Maybe he's dying. Maybe somebody he loves is dying. Maybe he's about to get his head chopped off. I always knew this day was going to come. I didn't know it was going to be today. And, you know, that happens to us in life so often, right? I knew this happened to people. I knew this could happen. But I didn't think it was going to happen today to me. You know, and what we want to do is escape from that situation, get away from that situation. But, you know, there's another way to face that situation, which is to become one with what's happening. And when you become one with what is happening, with the secondary, you could say, it takes you to your fundamentally awakened nature. And actually, nothing else can do that work, actually. No. So you know, if you have had an experience that's somewhat traumatic or hurtful or painful, you know, we say, I hate it, you know, this is unfair, blah, blah, blah. And it is, you know. But eventually, you know, if you sit with it and you just be, my job is to be present with what is happening. All of that emotional character goes away. And what takes its place is like liberation, kind of liberation. You know, I wouldn't call it just dispassion. You know, dispassion means I'm feeling no emotion. I would definitely say that the emotional character of Buddhism and Zen is not no emotion. I don't believe that. You know, when you are in the still place and things are no longer causing your reactive responses, you know, you begin to feel this, it's almost like a kind of excitement or a kind of joy. You know, there's a kind of joy to anticipation, you know, like pleasant anticipation. And pleasant anticipation comes from trust in the world, right? I mean, if we've been injured, we don't trust the world, and we don't have pleasant or joyful anticipation, right? We're full of dread. But, you know, when we understand that our job is to be present with what's happening, and we are present with what's happening, you know, we begin to enter this state of oneness. And that state of oneness connects us to like something larger than ourselves. And that sense of connection is exciting. And when you can sometimes feel on the cushion like this sort of like joy or excitement coming from being with what is happening, see, as you're working through your obstacles. And that sense of joy or excitement, it's like you're going to get a present, you know, you're waiting to get your present. That sense of joy or excitement is very close to what the Buddha meant by being awake, by being in nirvana. According to the Mahayana way of understanding things. So, you know, our goal is not to escape from samsara and enter nirvana. Our goal is to experience the nirvana which is here already. And paradoxically, the goal, the way to experience this is the way to experience the nirvana which is present is to be, the nirvana which is always here, is to be fully present with what's happening. I kind of blew that, so let me try again. You know, paradoxically, we think that to reach nirvana, we have to escape from what's happening in samsara. But the path to nirvana is samsara. The path to nirvana is being present with what is happening with samsara. And when we work through our fears and our attachments, we begin to become clear and we begin to feel this sense of connection and trust renewed. And when trust is renewed, you know, this sense of joy arises again. So this is really like the rhythm of practice. This is really what, it's the rhythm of life, right? You know, the rhythm of life, but more importantly, the rhythm of practice, you know. It's like, again and again, we get into a place where we feel blocked and we want to escape, but instead by being present with the obstacle, we turn it into a door. It becomes our gate into this trusting mind. Bodhidharma's highest truth. Emperor Wu's confusion. Vimalakirti's teaching of non-duality. Manjushri's verbal excess. Is there anyone who has the ability to enter in actively? Mihu had a monk ask Yamsha, do people these days need enlightenment or not? Yangshan said, it's not that there is no secondary, but what can be done about, it's not that there is no enlightenment, but what can be done about falling into the secondary? The monk went back and reported this to Mihu, who deeply agreed with this. Verse, the secondary, distinguishing enlightenment, breaking up delusion. Quickly, you should free your hands and relinquish net and trap. Accomplishment, before it's exhausted, becomes an extra thumb. Wisdom can hardly know, like you can't bite your own navel. The full moon's icy disk weeps in the autumn dew. The birds are cold in the jade tree. The dawn breezes chill. Brought forth, great Yan distinguishes real and false. Completely without flaw, the white jade is esteemed. So it's wisdom's already here. You can't achieve wisdom, right? Any more than you can bite your own navel, basically, is what it's saying. So anyway, we have been practicing, I hope, in this spirit today. And if not, please think about this way of practicing. And I look forward to our next opportunity to practice together. So thank you very much.